From WBUR Boston and NPR, I'm Ray Suarez of Al Jazeera America, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point. In this Holy Week, the most important days of fasting and festivals in the Christian calendar, culminating in Easter, we're looking at Americans who are not religious, people who self-identify as atheists, agnostics, or simply have no religious affiliation. They've been called, they call themselves, nuns, and now make up more than 20% of all U.S. adults, 35% of millennials. Yet the Republican presidential candidates who've actively recruited the deeply religious for decades have all but ignored them. This hour on Point, nuns and the new American religious landscape. You can join us on air or online. Are you a nun? I mean, N-O-N-E nun. An atheist, agnostic, someone who was raised in a religious group but simply opted out in adulthood. When presidential candidates eagerly court religious voters, where does that leave you? Join us anytime at onpointradio.org or on Twitter and Facebook at onpointradio. Joining me now from Claremont, California is Phil Zuckerman, professor of sociology at Pitzer College and author of Living the Secular Life and The Non-Religious, Understanding Secular People and Societies. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. Thanks so much for having me.
And with me in the studio is Angie Thurston, master's student at Harvard Divinity School and president of the Harvard Divinity School Nuns. She is co-author of the report, How We Gather, about millennials and their communities. In his inaugural address in January 2009, President Obama addressed nonbelievers.
We are a nation of Christians and Muslims, Jews and Hindus, and nonbelievers.
What was new about that is that he was acknowledging that there was a vast population inside our country that was not, as is so often invoked in political speech in this country, an active member of a religious organization. And that percentage of the population, Professor, has only grown in the years since then, hasn't it?
Oh, absolutely. Unprecedented growth.
Give us some ideas about how many Americans we're talking about.
Well, right now we're looking at around 58 million adult Americans who say they have no religion, just in terms of numbers. But if you just think about it percentage-wise, you know, back in the 1950s, maybe 2 or 3% of Americans said they had no religion. By 1990, it was only around 8% said they had no religion. By 2001, it was at 14%, and it's grown every single year, 16% by 2010. And now, as you've said, at the low estimate, it's around 22-23%, but I've seen Baker and Smith's data have it as high as 28.5%. So somewhere around 25% of American adults now nationally say they do not affiliate with a religion, and we've never seen anything like this in American history.
We don't have a time machine, and it's hard to talk to people on the streets of America in 1955, but do you suspect that 2-3% number was actually higher, but because of social pressure, because of just the flavor of community life, there were a lot of people who just chose to affiliate in some public way just to make life easier where they lived.
Oh, no doubt about it. And that's always been the case throughout history. In fact, there's always been doubters, skeptics, non-believers who had to keep their mouths quiet for threat of everything from social stigma to being burned at the stake. So we know that throughout Western history, it's always been a dangerous position to hold, although it's becoming more and more acceptable. And you also have to remember back in the 50s too, we had this arch enemy of godless communism over there in the Soviet Union, which made it even more sort of American to be religious and to be part of a congregation, part of a religious community. So definitely back in the 50s, it was there was a lot of social pressure, political pressure to identify as religious. But even if people were keeping it concealed, I still don't think it was 25% of the U.S. population. I do think so yes, there's been a more acceptance now. People are more openly secular, and people are starting to understand what that means, which is allowing greater numbers to come out of the closet, so to speak. But I also do think people are just starting to lose interest in religion. They're losing their faith. They're not attracted by religious congregations anymore. So you got both things happening, I think, at the same time.
Angie Thurston, ready to come out of the closet? even if they are a student at divinity school. Tell us about why there is a group called the Harvard Divinity School Nuns. How did they get there in the first place?
That's a great question. What we've discovered in this group, which we founded 3 years ago, is that there is a large and growing population, even in the divinity school, of students who I would describe as religiously homeless. And what's interesting about that is this statistic, which Professor Zuckerman cited, of the 58 million who are unaffiliated, is comprised of atheists and agnostics, but that's actually less than a third of the total population. More than two-thirds of the religious nuns are actually what's called nothing in particular. And within that is a very heterogeneous mix of people who, in many cases, do believe in God, more than one-fifth pray daily and have some sense of a higher power, and yet are unhoused in their religiousness. So this student group that we formed, the religious nuns, while it does include atheists and agnostics, it also includes many folks who have a deep, but I would say personal, understanding of their religion and spirituality.
So they wouldn't embrace, welcome, or associate at all with the labels agnostic or atheist.
Correct.
And yet, I think that revealing title, How We Gather, speaks to something deep in people who have for centuries found churches, mosques, synagogues to be a vessel for social life. When you don't buy into the precepts of the place, you still need some place to gather with people.
Absolutely. And I think what we're facing is a crisis of isolation in this country, and that is in part precipitated by the large numbers of people who are leaving organized religion. It's also precipitated by things like this widespread virtual interconnectivity mixed with a local sense of not knowing one's neighbors. And so we get these statistics like 1 in 4 people saying in this country that they have no one to talk to. And yet my research has focused on a counter-narrative to that, which is largely a story of hope and courage about this situation, which is looking at where are the emerging places that people are coming together, even if they're not in the traditional forms and especially the religious forms. So How We Gather, this report, looked at many so-called secular organizations, everything from CrossFit, which many people know, to some organizations that are less well-known that are doing things like arts-based community development, morning dance parties, you name it. And these are places where people are coming together and they are having experiences that seem to go beyond the functions that the organizations promote. So beyond physical fitness, people are finding things like personal transformation. They're finding community. And we're hearing stories of people, in some cases, doing things like creating meal plans for someone who's facing cancer or moving to a different location so they can be closer to their CrossFit box. These are things that we might have associated with church, and yet they're happening in places outside of the traditional structures.
Professor Zuckerman, are those people who are just simply unhoused or unhoused at the moment very different from people who have made the affirmative declaration that there is no supernatural being who took a part in the creation of the world? There is no being that's beyond human sight who understands human affliction and shares human sorrows. Are we talking about very different people inside that 58 million number that you gave us?
Absolutely. And I think one of the exciting things about taking secularity seriously is we're actually starting to go in and differentiate. You know, up until now, the non-religious have kind of been an undifferentiated mass, a sort of residual category. And we know that religion comes in so many shapes and sizes, and there's so many shades and hues of religiosity. And yet we don't realize that the same, almost to the same degree, is found in secular culture as well. And it's very important, I think. You know, Angie did a great job of saying, you know, look, not all of these nothing in particulars are atheist agnostics. And I would say many of them are indifferent. And, you know, Steve Bruce is a sociologist from Scotland who said, you know, the final stop of the train of secularization is not atheism. It's indifference. You know, when you're an atheist, you still, you're against something. You still, there's something to be a not believer in, and you take a position. You're still dancing with religion. You're dancing with theism. Islamism. The truly non-religious, in my opinion, are the indifferent, the ones who just don't care. They're oblivious. Religion is so unimportant in their lives, they don't even need to take a stand against it. And so absolutely, there's a huge difference between the unchurched, let's say, and the non-believers, and we could even tease that out more. But I do want to share some data. You know, Pew went into the non-religious category, those that ticked none of the above, and asked them, are you looking for a congregation? Are you looking for a religion that might be right for you? 89% said they were not seekers. They weren't looking for anything. So they seem to be quite comfortable in their non-affiliation. And the last little bit I just want to say, and I have, Angie, you do great work. When I get your brochures and your publications in the mail, I just light up and smile. It's just fantastic to read about the enclaves that you're observing and studying. But I do want to say we have to be careful about the labels atheist and agnostic and the orientations of atheist and agnostic. Most people do not like to self-label as either of those. They're especially atheists. They're highly stigmatized. But when we ask people just not how they identify, but just in terms of their orientations, the American Religious Identification Survey found that around 47% of the nuns are atheist or agnostic in orientation, but not necessarily self-labeling, because again, these are highly stigmatized identities.
From Facebook, Joe writes, "My community is at my local coffee shop, my music collective where I rehearse and practice my instrument, my family and their friends. Churches that spend money on billboards are not churches. They're power-hungry capitalists." We'll get to more of your comments and your calls. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point. This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about nuns. That's N-O-N-E-S. Those people who have no religious affiliation, and how they are changing the American religious, cultural, even political landscape. You can join the conversation. Non-believers, have you found communities you turn to outside of religious establishments? Do you feel a stigma attached to being a non-believer, a nun? Does that depend to some degree where you are in the country? We're with Phil Zuckerman, professor of sociology at Pitzer College and author of Living the Secular Life, and Angie Thurston, master's student at Harvard Divinity School and president of the Harvard Divinity School Nuns. We'll go to a call now. Davian is with us from Nashville, Tennessee. Welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I am in complete agreement with both of your guests this morning. I want to first thank you for having this conversation. But the depth of understanding by your female guest, Miss Thurston, is astounding. I completely fall in the category which she so well articulated. I'm from a deeply religious background. My parents were very devout, but I myself would consider myself a nun because I don't just adhere to all the tenets of organized religion, particularly organized Christianity. But I do have a faith, a personal faith, and I do agree that there's something more powerful than myself in this universe. My wife, who is from a background which was not as religious as I am, has always sought for our children to have a religious, at least a background, at least some knowledge or a foundation of that. But invariably, when we try churches, we find that they have just been corrupted. Not out of fault, but just out of the human condition. You know, the institutions that humans always create, they always are corrupted just by the way that human beings are. My question, though, is to your guests, is if we, when we do talk about agnostics and atheists, or as your other guests put it, indifference, do we not open ourselves up to problems there? Because I think the human condition is such that it has to. It yearns for something stronger or more powerful than itself, and when we have nothing to cling to and nothing to believe in, then we know, I guess it can tie back into your earlier hour where the mind or the human searches for something, and in that it can open itself up to, what we might conventionally call evil.
Davian, I'll put your call to Angie Thurston. Your question.
Thank you, Damian. And yes, I would agree with you. And I appreciated Professor Zuckerman bringing up the fact that so many of the nuns identify the fact that they're not looking for a religious community. But I think a lot of the time what that means is that they're not looking for a community that has a creed as the threshold for belonging. And yet, in my work with the unaffiliated, I have found that to a person, most everyone is looking for a community of meaning. And what we're seeing here, I think, looks less like a process of secularization and more like a paradigmatic shift from an institutional understanding of religion to a more personal understanding. But the question that arises then is, how do we form community around that? And I turn sometimes to the work of Paul Bourne, who talks about when we're in a situation of shallow community, which I think is often the case right now, you have room to deepen it in important ways, but you also have room to form community in a fear-based and often exclusionary way. And that can be the risk of the kind of moment we're living in. So it's the reason that I've been looking for examples of communities that are able to bring people together from a diversity of backgrounds and a diversity of belief systems that are then able to still come together to form something meaningful that allows each person to grow spiritually and to become better in their civic and personal lives.
Professor, you heard Davian talk about how he was raised in a religious family and turned away from it himself. Are there more intergenerational nuns, people who are young adults who were raised by adults who also were not religiously affiliated, or maybe even going back another generation after that?
I'm one of them. I'm a third generation non-believer. All four of my grandparents were non-religious, non-believers. So the vast majority of people who are non-religious today were raised with some type of religion, which, as you said at the start of the show, at some point they decided to opt out. But we are seeing a growth of actual people raised in secular homes. So I would say back in the 60s and 70s, again, it was less than 5% of Americans said they were raised with no religion. Today, for the first time, at least as of 2012, we have over 11% of Americans now saying they were raised in homes with no religion. And it's a small number, but if you think about it, I mean, African Americans make up about 12.5% of the U.S. population. So that gives you a demographic to compare it to. We're actually seeing sort of secular socialization happening now. And we've seen it as well in Canada, Australia, New Zealand, Northern Europe. I mean, many societies, Japan, where we have growing proportion of the population raising their children without religion.
You know, the thing that fascinates me about that is that Christianity has been so culturally influential in the history of this country that even if you're a non-believer, in some ways you speak a language that's heavily marked by the presence of Christianity in this country without even realizing it. You use phrases that come from the King James Bible, from the Anglican Book of Common Prayer, of cliches, sayings, refrains that people use in their conversation. They're speaking religious language without being aware of it. I guess as more people are not brought up with those ideas, they will be increasingly unaware of the influence, the marking of Christianity on the culture, for better and worse, but there it is.
Oh, absolutely. No doubt about it. It's part of our history. It's part of our culture. But I feel like the caller we just heard from actually illustrated it more deeply than even these phrases. You notice that the caller had a real pessimistic view of humanity. He said that any human organization is going to be corrupt. He said that humans are ultimately going to, if they don't believe in a higher power, going to turn toward evil. That's a deeply Christian concept of humanity, that we're all born sinners, that evil is lurking. You must believe in God in order to be good, and if you don't, and all human endeavors tends towards corruption, which is simply not, as a secular humanist, I reject that with every fiber in my being. I think humans are capable of great goodness, and we don't all turn towards corruption and evil. So I agree with you that yes, there's a sort of a cultural Christianity that pervades society, but like you said, it's for some for good, but some for ill. And I'd like to see us move past that notion of we're all born sinners. It's just simply not true.
Joining me now via Skype from Chicago is Deborah Jian Lee, journalist and radio producer and author of Rescuing Jesus: How People of Color, Women, and Queer Christians Are Reclaiming Evangelicalism. She's also co-founder of One Book, One Church, a national interchurch book club. Deborah Jian Lee, great to have you with us.
Thanks for having me here.
I saw in your book your feeling that this is not necessarily a one-directional movement, that people who are in are moving out, and that's all there is to it. There's something a little more subtle going on in your view?
Yeah, there's a lot of movement taking place and in a lot of different directions. The two big trends that I'm seeing are that young evangelicals are either leaving the church or they're staying within it and trying to reshape it from within. When you look at millennial evangelicals, there's this huge disenchantment with the culture wars and what the religious right has done to the evangelical church over the past several decades. And as a result, yes, many are becoming nuns. Many are becoming religiously unaffiliated, but many more are also staying within the evangelical church and forming these new communities within evangelical subculture and changing it from within. So the thing that I noticed in my research was that these groups, the groups that were doing this, were really the groups that have been traditionally on the margins of evangelicalism. People of color, women, queer Christians, people who have routinely been ostracized from evangelical culture and leadership, are now forming these communities, coming out in a way, and starting to create these communities that not only help nurture themselves within evangelicalism, but also to minister to the very people who have rejected them and to teach them that there's more than one way to be an evangelical. And there can be this decoupling of evangelicalism from politics and, the religious right.
In your book, you tell the story of many individual believers and their heartbreaking stories of rejection, of alienation, of being in effect called out by their church, which instead of becoming a nurturing home for them and their soul's home, in effect, became this place that was poisonous to them. Do those people heading out the door end up with no church home, or do they just find a new one, or does it vary from person to person?
Oh, it certainly varies. One of the really interesting things that I'm seeing is this new concept called Church in the Wild. And this is for people, I kind of identify with this myself, people who have been orphaned by evangelicalism, people who have been rejected by the evangelical church because of their identities, because of their beliefs. And what they're doing is some people are kind of lost in the wilderness. Other people are finding each other in the wilderness and creating these new communities, whether it's online or through conferences. And others are forming kind of these underground communities within the evangelical church itself. And those underground communities are slowly coming to the surface and starting to educate the people in privilege around them about what it's like to be the other within a evangelical church. Those are kind of the trends that I'm seeing. I'll give you one example. One of the big things I'm seeing is the development of the queer underground within evangelical Christian colleges, evangelical megachurches, congregations. These are groups of people who are finding each other, who have been traditionally ostracized from the evangelical church, but are finding each other and finding community and, ministering to each other in the shadows of an evangelical culture that rejects them. And as a result, they're finding ways to elevate their voices within the evangelical church. And it's been really tremendous just to document how that community is actually changing policies. It's pushing pastors to grapple with this question. Where do I stand on same-sex marriage? Where do I stand on the inclusion of people who are sexual minorities? And it's really creating this tipping point in the evangelical church and changing how the evangelical church is approaching this community.
Deborah Jian Lee is with us for the rest of the program, along with Phil Zuckerman and Angie Thurston. Let's go back to the phones. Danielle is calling from Charleston, South Carolina. Danielle, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. Thanks for having me. My husband and I both grew up in pretty religious families. I was raised Catholic, and he was raised pretty strict Mormon. And we've chosen to raise our children without religion. I guess you'd probably call us nuns. We don't really label ourselves as such, but we don't really label ourselves as anything. My comment was to agree with with your caller from, or with your guest from Harvard, in that we've sort of had to, in this community where we live, which is very religious, had to find our own social groups that are not based on church. And, you know, growing up, we both found our social groups because we just happen to be going to the same church with them, and you're sort of forced to be friends with the people that you see every Sunday. Here, we've had the freedom to find our own social groups and our own, what we call our tribe, based on our interests, which has been, for us, really refreshing, and hopefully for our children, something that they can move forward with in their lives without having to feel like they're being only allowed to be friends with the people they see at church.
So I know that you don't want to tell every stranger, especially in a community in South Carolina, your life history when they ask. But when someone asks, hey, Danielle, what are you? What's your answer?
Sometimes I say liberal, and that usually makes them stop talking. you know, we say that we are people of the earth, and we see our interconnectivity with all of our fellow humans. And while we respect everyone's personal opinions, our decision is to raise our family free of religious doctrine. And if they choose to become religious someday in their lives, it'll be their choice, but it won't be a choice that we thrust upon them.
Angie Thurston.
Well, thank you, Danielle. And I think that that really goes to show that one of the great challenges we're facing right now is around language. And when we started the Religious Nuns group, we looked at first for positive language. One of the early names of the group was the HDS Humanists. But when we looked at the group of us that started that program, we realized that none of us actually identified positively as humanists. And so at the moment, this language of nothing in particular, none of the above, unaffiliated, spiritual but not religious, and the longer explanations of the kind that Danielle is giving, that is what we're resorting to. But when we're striving to come together, that can be one of the challenges we face, is how do we speak to each other and speak to the larger society about who and what we are, as Danielle said, as people of this earth.
Inocencio in Miami Beach, Florida, wants to get into the conversation. Inocencio, welcome.
Thank you, Ray. And it's nice to have you back. I remember you moderating Talk of the Nation, and I think you're a greatly talented moderator, and you have a warm and soothing voice, which is easy on the ears. So I'm glad to hear you back on the radio. I believe in my I'm basically have a comment. I'm sorry, I'm a little
sure.
nervous.
No, go ahead.
I think religion is being replaced to a great deal, especially with millennials, by political movements. For example, like Black Lives Matter, what I consider the cult of racism, I say it's cult-like because they come up with these tortured logic arguments that, you know, blacks can't be racist. But anyway, that's basically my comment. I mean, me personally, I was raised very religious, and I used to be very, very religious. But now I'm vacillate between agnosticism and just full-blown atheism.
Was there a break point, Inocencio? Was there a moment or a transition that you can remember where you were in and then you were out?
Yeah. My personal life experiences just, led me to agnosticism and atheism. Well, actually, I went to atheism, then I started thinking, well, maybe agnosticism, and now I kind of vacillate between the two. But I really believe that science and math can really answer all the questions eventually. I mean, it may take time, it's not going to happen right away, but, if you look at it, science and math progressively, bit by bit, are answering more and more and more questions that people have about life and the meaning of life, existence, all those things.
Inocencio calling from Miami Beach, Florida. We're talking about the growing number of people who consider themselves non-religious. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. This is On Point.
This On Point podcast is supported by Squarespace. If you have a passion that you obsess over, if it keeps you up at night, if you live for it, you should show it off. With easy-to-use tools and templates, Squarespace helps you showcase every detail of what drives you. Because if it's worth the effort, it's worth showing to the world. Start your free trial today. Visit squarespace.com/onpoint. That's squarespace.com/onpoint. Squarespace.
This is On Point. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook. We're talking about how more people are turning away from organized religion and some turning away from God. You can join the conversation. What's your question about our changing religious landscape? Have you wondered where you fit in? We're talking with Phil Zuckerman, professor of sociology at Pitzer College and author of Living the Secular Life, and with Angie Thurston, master's student at Harvard Divinity School and president of the Harvard Divinity School Nuns, and Deborah Jian Lee, author of Rescuing Jesus, How People of Color, Women, and Queer Christians Are Reclaiming Evangelicalism. Let's go to Omaha, Nebraska next. Jim is calling. Jim, welcome to On Point.
Hi, Ray. I'm a nun because back in the 70s, I would go to Mass and I would see these people reciting these prayers by memory without any passion to it at all. And I think they did that because they literally felt that if they didn't go to Mass and follow the third commandment, they would go to hell. And actually, they felt that if you weren't Catholic, you'd go to hell. And I found this quite repulsive, and I quit going. Now, I still consider myself maybe not a spiritual person, but I'm still a moral person, and I still try to follow the golden rule as much as possible.
I have no doubt that you are a moral person, but it's interesting to me that when you found yourself rejecting, repulsed by even, the worship in your home church, you didn't find a different church that maybe fit your concept of worship better, but dropped out altogether. How come that happened?
I think that other interests, like really my job, took over, really, and I didn't feel like I needed some community at that time.
So all the things that the room in your life that church might have taken up, may have once taken up, there's other things in there now.
That's correct. It was occupied by other things, like my schooling, for example. That really took over.
And you haven't missed it since?
To tell you the truth, I haven't missed it at all, and I have not raised my children Catholic either.
Phil Zuckerman, what do you make of Jim's call?
I think it's indicative of the larger social trend. People are dropping out, and most people that do don't miss it. They fill their lives with work, family, friends, hobbies, and creativity, politics, you name it. Although the downside is a higher degree of individualism, so we do have to wonder what, you know. To me, the greatest value of religion is not the supernatural beliefs, certainly not the notion that we all need salvation or whatnot, but the community, the sacralizing of time passing, rituals, coming together with different generations, different people from different walks of life, bound together with certain sense of being part of a community, a moral community. And I don't know how we're going to replace that in secular culture. I think that's the biggest challenge of secular culture. But I think the caller's trajectory is pretty typical and becoming more typical.
You know, I haven't mentioned this during the program because I didn't want everybody to listen with a second set of ears and try to filter everything that I said for the whole hour. But I'm an active member of a Christian congregation. I'm the father of an ordained cleric. And she's just starting her career in the church and, frankly, wondering who'll be out there later when she's in her 40s and 50s. Will she be talking to a room full of empty pews? Will there even be pews, or will church be an entirely different experience by then? Deborah Jian Lee?
Yeah, when you look at the millennials, you're definitely seeing this reinvention of what church is. And I have a lot of hope for the future of the church, because when I look at the numbers, when I look at the cross-section of data, I see that there people are leaving the church, but other people are replacing them. So often the polls look at just one small segment of the population, and that is typically white evangelicals. And that excludes just the entire spectrum of Christian believers who come from different backgrounds. Just look at the data and you see that in the denominations that are 90, 95% white, their numbers are tanking. But when you look at evangelicals, when you look at their numbers are staying steady. That doesn't mean that there's no movement. It's because a lot of young white millennials are leaving and a lot of people of color are taking their place. A Pew Religion Landscape survey shows that from 2007 to 2014, people of color went from 19% of the evangelical population to 24%. And demographers and church growth experts are seeing that the evangelical church is following the same trajectory as the U.S. Census. That is, it's going to be a majority-minority population by 2040. So I don't see the church disappearing. I see the church changing radically, and I see churches who are able to invite and really include and celebrate the diversity of humanity. Those are the ones that are going to survive. The ones that can't do that, that continue to make church about boundaries and who's in and who's out, those churches are going to become relics or on the fringes of our society.
Angie Thurston, the people who are going to invent that next generation of religious experience are your classmates at Harvard Divinity School.
That's right. And it's quite a thrill to be among them, actually. And Deborah's right. You know, we have 3,500 churches closing per year in this country, but there is a different story. With my colleague at HDS, Casper Turkile, we just wrote a new report called Something More, which is all about these emerging spiritual communities across religious traditions. And of course, there's a great deal of concern and alarm among religious leadership at the center of denominations. But I've been really heartened to get to be part of a number of large-scale conversations with those leaders who are looking at the innovators at the margins of their communities who are fostering new forms of religiosity in community. And so a few of those examples, a group called the Sanctuaries in D.C. is a diverse arts community with soul, as they self-describe, and it's led by a Unitarian Universalist ordained minister, but the group itself is multiracial and multispiritual. We have a group called Sunday Assembly, which others have heard of, I know, which is a secular congregation that celebrates life, and they're growing around the world among folks who are interested in living better and yet are not necessarily convinced by the existence of a supernatural God. And then in between, we have a number of across traditions, Buddhist, Muslim, and Jewish groups, which are growing among millennials especially, and even those who do not identify with those traditions themselves.
You know, a lot of people have tried to get in on this conversation, and it's so rich and so complicated. We could do a whole week on this, but I'm going to ask the callers to cooperate with me and cooperate with their fellow callers. Let's get on, make the point you have to make, and then I'll go to somebody else just so we can get more voices in here. Susan is calling from one of the coldest places in America, Saranac Lake, New York. Susan, welcome.
Hi, Ray. Well, I lost my faith when I was about 18, and what triggered it was I was raised Catholic, and somehow eating a hot dog on Friday was going to send me to hell seemed a little bit silly. And I haven't replaced it. I feel I've lost a big part of myself in losing a faith. But I think that religion is beyond our, you know, answers to what we're doing here are beyond our little brains. And we're all going to come up short with the definition. I think a moral code is probably a construct that we in society make, and I live according to the moral code of Christianity, but I think that it's made up.
Susan from Saranac Lake, New York, thanks a lot for your call. LD is next. He's calling from West Hartford, Connecticut. LD.
Hi, Ray.
Hi.
I left the church after graduating from eighth grade when Billy Joel came out with the song, Your Mother Never Cared For Me, But Did She Ever Say a Prayer For Me? And I realized the hypocrisy of the whole institution a feminist and the role of women in the church. And I haven't missed it. My children are very moral. They were born with a sense of morality. They didn't need the fear of death and retribution after life. It's right here. We do the best we can today and every day, and I don't find that I or my friends or my family need religion, nor do I find individualism to be a frightful thought like your guest.
We'll go from West Hartford, Connecticut, clear across the country to Spokane, Washington. Malia, welcome to the program.
Hi, Ray. This is a really, really great show. And it's very interesting because what I've found in Spokane is this incredible community that goes across all bounds of all boundaries of race, religion, and that is the contra dance community here in town with the Folklore Society. And it is a group of folks, a lot of these people have been dancing together for 30 years. And they're from all over the country. They're from all over the world. They go to dance camps. These are grown-up camps where you go for a week, you go for a weekend. And people come together, they share their lives, they dance together. They take care of each other when they're sick. You know, we're there for each other when you die, when people are born, children are raised through the community. It's phenomenal. And it doesn't look at race. It doesn't look at religion. It doesn't look at any faction of a human being except that we all care about each other and we love music and we love to dance.
Malia, thanks a lot for your call. Really great insights from people all across the country. I didn't want to leave this hour without giving my three guests a chance to weigh in on the 2016 presidential election, because we're ending a really three or four decades of frank religious appeals to voters on the part of politicians. Bernie Sanders is trying something very different. The candidates still remaining in the Republican race are doing a lot of God talk in their speeches to small groups and talking about their own faith. Are we looking at one of the last elections where that's going to be a big feature of the campaign? What do you think, Phil Zuckerman?
Let's hope. My goodness. I just think it's so ironic that the candidates that most say they love God and most say they love the Bible are the same candidates who don't want to fight global warming. They love guns. They don't want to fight inequality. They don't want to fight racism. They're the most regressive force politically. And that here you have Bernie Sanders, a non-believer in God, who can't admit it outright but can do so as best he can by evading the question, who's the most concerned with inequality, who's the most concerned with saving the planet, who's really the most peace-loving and social justice candidate out there. I don't see religion going away anytime soon in our political landscape, but I do hope that more and more Americans start to understand that morality is not the monopoly of those who wear their religion on their sleeve, that it's actually well-seeped in secular culture as well, and that I hope we have more political candidates who will no longer try to win votes by drenching themselves in the blood of Jesus, but will actually care about making the world a better place with their policies.
And we've got time for final comments from Deborah Gian Lee.
Yes. I mean, the way I see it is young, religious, non-religious people, they're smart. They see through the marketing ploys of politicians who, you know, as Phil said, wear their religion on their sleeve. And what they're interested in, the people that I'm interviewing, they are interested in the issues, understanding where do these politicians stand on the issues that I care about. And among young millennials who are increasingly progressive and see things not as black and white but as gray, they are interested in social justice. They are interested in seeing the least of these be cared for. And they're interested in seeing their politicians truly enact policies that are inclusive of everybody. And I think that's going to be a huge challenge for the Republican candidates. And I think that's why so many more people are moving away from the religious right and pushing themselves towards a more progressive, in some ways, prophetic faith outlook.
Angie Thurston, might it be much much less a matter of belief than just demographics? You'll be frankly not talking to very many people after a while.
That's true. As the millennials get older, we have more and more people who fall into the unaffiliated camp. And we hear the callers today saying their associations of religion with hypocrisy, with fear-mongering, with exclusion. And what I've gotten the privilege of being exposed to in divinity school is these many gifts of the heart of religiosity. But what the disconnect seems to show is that in some way, religion, the best of religion, is not doing its job as concerns the social fabric of this country right now. And yet there is clearly much work to be done. So my hope is that when we hear something like from Bernie Sanders of religion being his way of saying all people are connected, that there's more and more language that actually speaks to the experience of this rising generation and this country in general that can be a uniting rather than a dividing factor.
From our website, onpointradio.org, CM writes, in higher education contexts at least, the old order of nuns being cultural outcasts has switched to be a believer is now the one who's stigmatized among educated people. Agnes writes, I am a nun. I believe in a higher being, being a decent person. I don't believe in organized religion. I don't care what people think of me or my beliefs. Why should I? I will not pretend to be who I am, not just to fit in. That is an awfully tiring way of living. And Barpo writes, my yoga-based meditation and practice are my religion. I have a meditation teacher and spend an hour and a half a day in meditation and go to 4 asana classes weekly. This is the community from which I draw my deep spiritual life. I don't believe in a personal God, but I do believe and experience an intelligent energy that pervades the universe and moves it. Phil Zuckerman is the author of Living the Secular Life. Thanks for coming on.
My pleasure. Thanks so much for having me.
Angie Thurston, president of the Harvard Divinity School Nuns. Great to see you.
Likewise.
And Deborah Gian Lee, author of Rescuing Jesus. Thanks for joining us.
Thanks, Ray.
You can continue the conversation and get the On Point podcast at our website, onpointradio.org. You can follow us on Twitter and find us on Facebook at On Point Radio. Coming up tomorrow, we'll look at the future of the American university with today's rising costs, what some say is unfair admissions practices, and threats to academic freedom. I'm Ray Suarez, in for Tom Ashbrook, and this is On Point.